According to the Global Wellness Institute, the global fitness industry is projected to be worth $1 trillion in a couple of years' time. But for most of modern history, physical training was the preserve of athletes and eccentrics. In his latest book, Sweat, journalist and photographer and exerciser Bill Hayes traces the origins of exercise. Hayes' previous books explored sleep and blood, and in a memoir called Insomniac City, he wrote about New York and his life with his late partner, neurologist and author Dr. Oliver Sacks. He is the creative director of the Oliver Sacks Foundation, and he's with me now. Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me.
Very nice to talk to you. What is the earliest, the very earliest evidence we have found of exercise for the sake of exercise?
Really, the earliest evidence we have is about the 5th century BC, when Hippocrates, now known as the father of medicine, articulated the tenets of exercise, why it's beneficial for human beings. In fact, he wrote up 2 treatises on healthful living, including diet and exercise. And it was Hippocrates who said, eating alone will not keep a man well. He must also take exercise. For food and exercise, while possessing opposite qualities, yet work together to produce health. So really, it's Hippocrates who became the first sort of advocate from a medical or physician's perspective to write and talk about exercise. Although one could say its origins go even further back, for example, to the founding of the Olympic Games in the 8th century BC, when fitness training or exercise, you might say, was certainly part of the regimen for competing.
I didn't realize that Plato was given his name on account of the broadness of his physique.
That's true. There are so many things I discovered while doing research for this book. That came as a really big surprise. Yeah, his given name was Aristocles, and he was a competitive wrestler as a young man. In fact, there were 4 different athletic games, not just the Olympic Games, but games at Isthmia, Nemea, and Delphi. And Plato competed as a wrestler at Isthmia, and his coach gave him the name Plato from the name or word Platon for broad-shouldered, because apparently he was very broad-shouldered. Yeah, it was his nickname, I guess.
Why was wrestling so big in ancient Greece? I mean, it was the thing, wasn't it?
It really was the thing, and exercise and athletic competition was definitely limited only to men and to boys. I think its origins come out of training for the military, which we can trace back beyond the 10th century BC to military states like Sparta, where exercise and training were part of everyday life. And wrestling and boxing were, considered forms of exercise or training to get ready for hand-to-hand combat.
It's always a bit suspect, isn't it, exercise? Because there is always that, I'm thinking about the Nazis. There's always that kind of militaristic or narcissistic hue to it.
That is part of the history of exercise, that's for sure. And it pops up at different times over in history. In particular, in the 19th century, there was a figure named Per Henrik Ling out of Stockholm, Sweden. And he was really the kind of the innovator of giant group fitness classes. The descendant of that would be a group fitness class, like an aerobics class we have today. But he designed his own technique, really a kind of tightly choreographed calisthenics for both men and women, although they were kept separate, all sort of with a drill master telling people what to do.
And they had uniforms, right?
And they had uniforms, and it was part of a kind of nationalistic training, getting the country ready for the possibility of invasion or war. So it was called somatic nationalism. There was a kind of definitely a nationalist spirit to it, which then got sort of used in much more evil ways during the Third Reich and the Nazi regime and other authoritarian regimes as well.
However, Ling got credit, as you say in the book, for actively encouraging exercise, among the first people anywhere to do this, exercise for women and children, and helping bring PE classes to schoolrooms in the US and the UK.
Yeah, he was a very important figure. He was the first to really encourage women to exercise, designing classes just for them. And one of the most important things he did was to establish an institute or university, really the first university devoted to exercise science, as we would call it today. It's still open today. I visited it in my many years of travels researching this book. And it was his hope to train teachers who would spread the Ling method around the world. And indeed they did, sending instructors, both male and female, to the UK and to the US and India, and spreading the Ling method.
Going back to the ancient Greeks, what was gloios?
I'm so glad you asked. Are you ready for this? Are you ready for this? In antiquity, the sweat of athletes was considered a precious commodity. They believed that the sweat and oil from supreme athletes must contain the essence of erete, or excellence. And they actually designed a tool sort of shaped like a celery stalk with which the athletes would scrape the sweat off their bodies or after exercising and funnel it into small clay pots. And this presumably very funky smelling mixture was called gloios, and it was sold at gymnasiums, sometimes for very high prices. You know, the better the athlete, the more champion, the more expensive the potion. Now, what's interesting about gloios, which some have called, you know, the first nutritional supplement in history, is that it was not used to like make you a better athlete or make you help you to run faster or lift more heavily. It was used for some of the most basic dermatological problems like hemorrhoids and warts. But it was a real thing.
And
it was a
real money.
It was a money maker. What do you think? I don't think so. I'm hoping no one gets the idea from reading my book to start marketing gloios in 2022.
I think that you describe what Greek athletes did to their bodies was to smear themselves with a mixture of olive oil and sand to protect themselves from the sun and to make them look glisteny. So gloios would have been a mix of olive oil and sand and sweat.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Oh. So it's this mix of oil and oil and sweat and dust, which they use to sort of to keep their skin tactile if they're wrestling, for example. Another thing which maybe has gone unsaid was that in antiquity, men exercised and athletes competed in the nude. In fact, the word gymnastics means to exercise in the nude. And one of the most important historical figures in my book, which traces exercise over the millennia from antiquity up to the present day, was a 16th century physician named Girolamo Mercuriale. Mercuriale is credited with writing the first comprehensive book on exercise, published in 1569. He's given credit for that major accomplishment. And I follow his footsteps in the book and really retrace his life, how he came to write Dell'Arte Gymnastica, the art of gymnastics, the art of exercise, really, and the various twists and turns of his very tumultuous life. And I weave together his story with the history of exercise, with a kind of a chronicle of my own history of exercise as I try out everything from running and swimming to boxing and yoga.
How responsible was he for a kind of revival of exercise? Because when Christianity took over, exercise became regarded as a self-indulgence, vanity. And it wasn't until the Renaissance and Mercuriale, his time, that exercise became a legitimate activity. How influential was Girolamo Mercuriale?
Well, that's such a good point. You know, there was this whole culture of athletics and exercise, so much a part of ancient Greece and Rome, a kind of worshiping of the body and of the athlete. And that really shifted with the rise of Christianity in the West. We're talking about in around, let's say, the 3rd and 4th centuries AD. With the rise of Christianity, there was a shift from worshiping the body with the athlete as the ideal to a focus on the soul and the spirit. And cathedrals replaced gymnasiums. And it was considered indecent or vain to exercise. And the idea was no longer the Olympic athlete, but instead the suffering Christian saint. And that was really the frame of mind for centuries until Mercuriali, who really did want to revive the ancient Greek art of exercise. Of course, this is in the spirit of the Renaissance, a renewed interest in the individual and in humanism, and a renewed interest in the thinkers and philosophers and physicians of antiquity, like Hippocrates and Plato and Galen and others.
So it's hard.
He really did want to revive the ancient Greek arts of exercise. I'm not sure he really achieved his aim.
No.
Nor did he become the Hippocrates of the Renaissance. He actually became a sort of forgotten figure. I had certainly never heard of him myself. It was only because of a very wonderful librarian here in New York who introduced me to Mercuriali and shared with me a pristine first edition of Dell'Arte Gymnastica from 1573.
And this took you all over the show, as you say, from New York to Rome and to Paris, to the archives of the Borromeo family.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite parts of the whole journey. It was a very spontaneous kind of journey through the history of exercise. I was just following my gut, following my research, going to libraries and archives all over the world. And one of the important things about Dell'Arte Gymnastica, Mercuriali's book, and the thing that struck me when I first saw it, was that it was illustrated, had these very captivating engravings done not by Mercuriali, but by a fellow named Piero Ligorio, who was in Rome at the same time as Mercuriali. And I became interested in tracking down the original drawings. I think there are 12 engravings in the book. And through a series of unexpected events, I was invited to La Isola Bella in Lake Como in northern Italy to go to the Palazzo Borromeo and see the actual drawings done by Piero Ligorio around 1572 or so. And very few people have seen them before. They're still held by the Borromeo family. And it was a magical, magical experience. It was almost like meeting Ligorio and Mercuriali myself. And just touching across the centuries.
He was an interesting man, wasn't he? I mean, Mercuriali, what was he famous for in his time as opposed to now?
Yeah, well, he kind of rose from complete obscurity to become the personal physician to a prominent cardinal in Rome, Cardinal Alessandro Farnese. And that's how he ended up in Rome. Farnese happened to be fairly young and healthy. So my impression is Mercuriali didn't have that much work to do. And he had access not only to the Farnese family library, but to the Vatican library. And it was there that he began digging through the books and manuscripts, and he deciphered and translated the works of Hippocrates and Galen and others. And with that, you know, with those teachings and writings, began to try to revive the ancient Greek arts of exercise. He went from working for Cardinal Farnese to becoming personal physician to the Holy Roman Emperor, Maximilian, and then chair of medicine at the University of Padua. So he had a very distinguished career and ended up writing something like 15 books, but just was one of those figures who sort of got lost to history, in part because all of his books were written in medieval Latin. And in fact, one of my major challenges when I started this, and I was so captivated by this centuries old book, was I didn't read any Latin, and I had to track down an English translation, which I eventually did, as well as the actual translator himself and other experts on Mercuriale and on exercise, which kind of led me not around the world, but to many countries in the world.
One of his chapters is called A Refutation of Those Who Think Everyone Should Exercise.
Right. That was kind of refreshing. Mercuriale had a chapter saying, not everyone should exercise. Those who are older, those who are maybe injured, it's not necessarily a good thing for you. He was sort of giving a free pass to some people not to exercise. But like his ancestors, Hippocrates and Galen, he believed that exercise should be a part of your daily life, almost like a daily workout, as we would call it. That exercise should be moderate, don't overdo it, and stick to the ones that are, you know, fairly safe, like walking and running and swimming. He wasn't a big advocate of boxing and wrestling. Remember, he was looking at exercise purely from a physician's perspective and thinking of it prescriptively, you know, what's good for you or not. And one important thing, though, that you really need to keep in mind is that Mercuriale, like those who came before him, did not have an accurate scientific understanding of the workings internally of the human body. They still believed in the theory of the four humors, this kind of fantastical idea that there were four liquids or humors in the body that had to be kept in balance. And exercise was part of that. If one of the humors was out of balance, you were thrown into a state of distemper, and exercise could perhaps help in equalizing those humors. It really wasn't until the 18th century with William Harvey's discovery of the circulation of blood by the beat of the heart that we began to have an accurate understanding of the internal workings of the human body that led to a much more scientific understanding of why exercise is beneficial.
I've received a text from somebody called Jeff, which says, I've long found it a little strange that in the past our fitness was gained by hard physical work, which produced goods for which we were paid money, yet now we gain fitness through hard physical work, which produces nothing and for which we pay money, which echoes, I think, Alice Waters said to you, gyms are the fast food of exercise. How unpleasant that people think they must go to a gym to exercise. Nothing comes of it. Nothing is produced. People have lost the association between exercise and manual work, exercise and nature. Do you agree with her at all?
Well, I just thought it was such a stimulating and interesting way of thinking about exercise, and really in line with her thinking even about food. For her, exercise is just built into her daily life. It's part of working, going up and down the stairs at her restaurant, carrying boxes or produce, sweeping the steps and so forth. But I do beg to differ with Alice as well as the caller. It's not, I think, that exercise produces nothing. I think what it can produce is one feeling good about oneself. And I'm not even saying necessarily to lose weight, let's say. But getting some exercise really can make you feel good, both in body and mind. I think that's the most important thing. Yes, it's true that steady exercise is good for your health, and it's been proven can help you to live longer. But you never know. Life can be very short and unexpected. And when people ask me, how do you get motivated to exercise? I say, find a form of exercise that makes you feel good now, in the moment, in your body, about your life. And that's certainly something that my late partner, Oliver Sacks, inspired me, especially even in the last year of his life when he was exercising up until very nearly the day he died.
You went swimming a lot with him. Of course, he was a great swimmer. And when he died, you put this book aside. You didn't write in it for about 3 years, although you had plantar fasciitis as well, so a number of reasons. But was that because your heart was broken? You just lost interest? What?
I think, yeah, most simply, yeah, I think my heart was broken. I mean, it was devastating to lose Oliver. We were very much in love. We were lucky to have those last 8 months together. And swimming and exercise was part of our life together. We would go swimming two or three times a week at a nearby pool. As you said, he was a great swimmer, open water swimmer, as well as lap swimmer. And I had known how to swim when I was a kid, but I was never a serious swimmer until I got together with Oliver. And after his death, yeah, everything just kind of went silent. Certainly it was a grief. And I associated going to the pool or even going to the gym where we used to work out together. I associated it with him and just completely lost interest. I did go and I did set aside this book completely. I didn't open a file for about 3 years. But in that period, I wrote my memoir, Insomniac City. I'm also a photographer. I published a book of my street photography. And it really was because of the pandemic, having so much time, you know, especially during the first year, so much time alone here in my apartment, needing a project to work on, that I brought everything back out, all my research that I'd done, my travels, and I began working on the book again and completed Sweat during the pandemic.
In 2018, you say you were told by your doctor that you had high blood pressure and mm-hmm. you had to do cardio again.
Yes.
Why? What is the link between blood pressure and exercise?
Well, it's certainly very, very good for the heart, strengthening the heart muscle and... yeah, it's good for the entire body. So yeah, he did prescribe some blood pressure meds, but also said I had to get back into some cardio.
Are you still on the meds, or has cardio sorted it?
I'm still on a low dose of the meds, and also high blood pressure runs in my family. It can be genetic, so it's good to be on the meds, and I'm in great health, fortunately.
People are shouting at me to talk to you about yoga.
Mm-hmm.
Which, yoga of course, is a part of the book as well. You went to the home of yoga, did you not, in India?
I did, yeah. You know, I had practiced yoga pretty seriously for years, had a great yoga teacher. Kind of, I was always interested in different forms of exercise. For me, swimming, lifting, or working out at the gym, but then also doing yoga at least once a week. And yeah, I went to yoga. I mean, you went to yoga, went to India to study yoga and to really look into the origins of that practice, which were complex and hard to trace. Although what is clear is that yoga was introduced to the West, Western world, in the 19th century, when yoga masters or yogis came to Europe and came to the United States and traveled and lectured and demonstrated and brought yoga to the West as far back as the 19th century.
The Buddha, I am told by a listener, also talked about exercise in 500 BCE. He said, monks, there are these five benefits of walking up and down. What five? One is fit for long journeys. One is fit for striving. One has little disease. That which is eaten, drunk, chewed, tasted, goes through proper digestion. The composure attained by walking up and down is long-lasting. These, monks, are the five benefits of walking up and down.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
That is so wonderful. I wish I had that in my book. Thank you to the caller. It's amazing how often, over the course of the history of exercise, whether it's Hippocrates or Mercuriale or people today, walking is recommended as one of the best forms of exercise, brisk walking. And I really was reminded of that during the pandemic when gyms were closed. I had my little home exercise routine doing push-ups and sit-ups and some yoga at home, but I would make a point of going for a long walk, partly just to get out of my apartment and get some fresh air, but really, you know, thinking about it as a form of exercise, time to think and connect with other people, even just by, you know, glancing and waving and seeing people outside of my little apartment, something we probably take for granted.
There are those who scorn what they call gym junkies, and, mm-hmm. and you cite some of them in your book, you know, accusing them of narcissism. But what you mentioned earlier about feeling good about yourself mm-hmm. was clearly, I mean, one of the most poignant chapters in your book is your description of the AIDS epidemic in San Francisco when the disease killed so many. You worked at the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. It was important to feel good about yourself at that time, particularly, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And gyms played such a central role, especially in the gay community in cities like San Francisco or New York, or I imagine Sydney and Melbourne. To feel good about your body, also to build up your strength. My partner Steve had HIV AIDS. And, you know, one thing that was common back in those days, the late 80s, early 90s, was something called wasting syndrome, where, you know, the muscles would really be, waste away, you know. So there was a real medical reason to build up muscle within the body. But more importantly, gyms played the role of almost like community centers. The gym I went to, certainly, there were flyers for ACT UP meetings, flyers for Project Inform meetings, and also notices taped to the front desk for memorials of gym members who had died. And back in the late 80s, early 90s, in San Francisco, as in New York and other major cities, you know, men were dying all the time. I mean, all the time. You'd see a gym member who looked perfectly healthy one day, and then maybe a month later, you'd see a notice that there was a memorial for his death. I have reflected on the fact that I'm 61 and have lived through two pandemics now, the AIDS pandemic and the COVID pandemic. And the way exercise has played a role in each of these pandemics is so different and fascinating to think about the comparison.
Insomnia has dogged you. As you say, you wrote Insomniac City. You wrote about insomnia itself. Mm-hmm. Did exercise help with it?
I think so, absolutely. It always helps to sort of wear your body out. Which also can calm your mind.
And yet, so I would say, I mean, you are such an exercised person. Mm-hmm. And yet, it really never seemed to cure your insomnia, did it?
I would say no. I think for me, insomnia is that, you know, the root of it is just anxiety and stress. It's really about the mind more than the body. But I think exercise can help. But no, it didn't. It has not cured me of my insomnia.
Of all the things that you tried out in the process of writing this book and mm-hmm. researching this book, you know, the swimming and the yoga and the running and the boxing. And mm-hmm. actually you signed up, you became a personalized trainer, or effectively you could be because you did the course. Mm-hmm. What of those things has lasted? Are you carrying on with any of them as a result of the book?
Definitely. I mean, I got back into swimming more seriously than ever before. So that's a part of my life, part of my practice. I swim 2 or 3 times a week, a mile.
In a pool or in the ocean or what?
In a pool. Yeah, I'm here in Manhattan and I'm lucky that there's a really beautiful pool nearby, an indoor pool, but a really big, beautiful pool. So, I go there 2 or 3 times a week.
The latest thing, by the way, is ice swimming, or swimming in icy waters, for reasons that I can't be bothered going into now. But it sounds, I can see the advantages of it if one is up for it. Are you interested in that?
Yeah, in fact, you know what? The book opens with a scene of me plunging into an icy cold mountain lake. It's not something I do commonly.
Okay, but that was my question.
Yeah, I happened to be in an artist residency in the Adirondacks in the fall, and a beautiful lake, but it was October and the water was really cold, 50 degrees about. Yeah. But one day, it was just such a beautiful day. The lake just looked so calm. I couldn't resist. And so I plunged into that cold lake and swam as far as I could without, dying, and turned around and got back on the dock. And so the book opens with kind of a moment by moment description of everything I'm feeling, every sensation on my skin, the breathing, the sights underwater, and when I surface. I wanted throughout the book not only to give a chronicle of the history of exercise, but what it feels like in your body to exercise, whether that's plunging into a lake, lifting heavy weights, boxing, getting hit, getting knocked down, or hitting, or practicing yoga.
I take it you haven't taken up icy water swimming then, beyond that.
No, I have not. No, I like the what is our pool? Somewhere in the 70s. I think that's more my temperature.
Yeah. I mean, as one grows older, I suppose it's true that you don't want to make yourself feel the discomfort that might have been more challenging when you were younger. Is that fair to say?
I think that's fair to say, but I think I also did it on that day because I could, It's one thing I say to people, try things while you're still able to do it, because a time will come when you're older when you may not be able to do those things. And why not try pushing your body to the limits without injury? But if you're bored with whatever exercise you're doing, try something new. I also think, exercise doesn't have to take place in a gym. You could dance in your apartment for 15 minutes, or go play in the park with your kids, or if you have no time to exercise, get off the bus, three stops early on the way home from work, or the subway two stops early, and walk the rest of the way home. But as you make that walk home, do it with the intention that I am getting myself some exercise. Your body will thank you. You'll feel good about yourself, and you can not feel guilty about, missing the gym.
And these days, what are you doing? You're swimming? Are you running?
Swimming. No, I'm not a runner anymore. I wish I could be, but my feet and my knees just say no.
You know what?
But
I mean,
what?
you talk about your plantar fasciitis, and it's not your first exercise injury. And the people that I know who have exercised a lot are their bodies have suffered. You know, it's a balancing act, isn't it? As to whether
Yeah, it
you
is.
gain more than you lose.
Yeah, and I think I've definitely learned that lesson. When I was younger, I used to lift heavily at the gym, and that was important to me. I enjoyed it, but I also had a lot of injuries, including a torn rotator cuff muscle that was really painful, and other injuries, even abdominal tears, muscle tears. So yes, I still lift, but really much, much lighter weights. And lifting weights is good for you, even in older age. And no, I don't run, but I take brisk walks. And I think swimming, especially as I get older, is probably the better exercise for me. I did, for the book, experiment with boxing. That was very intense. I did a 6-week boxing boot camp. It was a serious boxing course. Glad I had the experience. It's chronicled in vivid detail in the book, but that's certainly something I would never do again.
No, I mean, what would the point be in getting whacked around the head constantly?
Well, it turns out that some people really enjoy
Yeah.
that. And
I know.
I learned that in the boot camp.
There
Some of
is
them really
no
enjoyed
accounting for that.
knocking me down. And I was pretty good at that part of it.
What's your next book going to be, Bill?
I'm not exactly sure, but I think I'm going to do another volume of my photography. My first volume was purely street photography. I moved to New York about 13 years ago, bought a camera, became a street photographer. But in the past 6 years, especially since Oliver's death, I've been doing more studio portraiture here in my apartment, which has a kind of studio space. It's a little bit exaggerated way to call it, but I think it will be a book of my portraiture.
Very nice to talk to you. Thank you. Bill Hayes, whose book is called Sweat, A History of Exercise.